wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
As I said earlier, bear with it, it'll be a very dusty show today as I've never done this before, but we are joined in studio by Dr. Davide Mercadante. How are you doing, Davide?
Not too bad, except from the weather, which is always like, ugh.
But, I know. We have a little patch of sunshine and then it's back to like sad grey.
It's like we get an evil little taunt of sun and then we're thrown back into the depths of
vitamin D deficiency. First up, you will be talking to us about how DNA barcoding can be used to detect what you eat. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
That's a very interesting story that I found, and is a story that comes from research carried out at Duke School of Medicine in the US, right. North Carolina, I think they are based, and basically researchers have developed these genetic markers to identify what you eat in terms of plants. So plant-based diets. This is particularly focused on plant-based diets.
Really?
Yes. And this is based upon the analysis or feces, fecal matter.
Mm.
This is not new. Often this happens. It's not like a nice job to have in the science department, let's say. I cannot imagine doing that. But anyway, in this case, researchers have identify the specific genetic region within the DNA of plants that can actually help distinguish plant families and even down to plant species.
Wow.
Yeah, and they basically have applied this to the analysis of fecal matters, which relates to what people eat in terms of plants. So this specific genetic region is a genetic region in an organelle that is specific to plants, to plant cells, which is the chloroplasts, which is where the photosynthesis happens.
Yep.
And of course, there is DNA material that is specific of plants, but is also diverse from plant to plant. And if you analyze this specific region, you can actually identify what is the plant that you have been processing through your guts.
Wow.
So they have analyzed more than 1,000 fecal samples. Again, not like an extremely good thing to have.
Not an ideal job.
Sorry about talking about this during lunchtime, lunch break. It's not great, I know. But from many participants, so 324 participants in total, and they knew that 20 of those participants had high diet standards. So they could have a mean of comparison between participants with the higher dietary standards compared to others. And they can find out basically what plants you are eating down to almost 500 different species of plants. So it's a very, very specific method. Not as specific as identifying everything, but it's a very specific method. And it is interesting what they found. This method does risk to revolutionize dietary data collection, because usually this is done with a questionnaire that you have to give to families, and this is slow. And sometimes, families are busy during their day. They miss details. While if you look at the DNA of plants that you have processed through your guts, you know what somebody has eaten.
Mm.
And after some tweaking, let's say, of this barcode, they are able to distinguish 83% of the plant commodities that you would naturally have with your food. So a very large majority of different plants. So what they found is actually very interesting. So they found things that are related to society as well as things that are related, let's say, to human physiology. So they have found that there are roughly 46 plant families and 72 different plant species in the diet of, let's say, an average adolescent.
Mm.
There are differences related to income.
Yes.
So they have actually found that, adolescents or even kids that come from richer backgrounds or higher income family, they have a much more varied diet in terms of like plant-based diet.
Right. Which
of course, pinpoints also to the potential of using this kind of barcoding to to sample, you know, societies or different slices of society. And interestingly enough, they also found that in life, if you take adolescent life, adolescents that have left home, they tend to eat much less plants. Mm. Much less.
I can speak for them. Yeah. Going to uni.
Fruit and vegetables. Yeah. So, and they, of course, I mean, they relate this to the fact that when you leave home and you leave that secure environment diet-wise, you may tend to leave a little bit the plant-based diet. It is an extremely sophisticated, say, way of looking at diets, but it's got limitations. So you cannot distinguish from some plant within some plant families that are very, very similar to each other. Like, for example, the brassica family, broccoli and Brussels sprouts.
Right.
They can say that you have been eating that, but they can't say if you have been eating broccoli or Brussels sprouts, and just because their DNA is actually too similar to be compared meaningfully, let's say. Yeah, so there is like a hope that this can be tweaked a little further to actually increase the coverage of plant-based diets.
Wow, that's fascinating. And next up, you're also going to talk about the chore of pecking.
Yeah. This is very interesting, especially for me. Sometimes, you know, I have to peck and move on, but... Yeah, the chore of pecking, this is research that comes from MIT, the one in Boston. And actually what they have done, they have taken the chore of pecking very seriously from a computational perspective. And you would be surprised to actually know how serious is how science has been taking this seriously. Since the 1600s, you know, Kepler, the same guy that has been coming up with some astronomical, you know, predictions, he actually offered the solution to peck in the most efficient way a group of spheres. I don't know if you have ever seen, for example, in the supermarkets, right, when you see these mountains of oranges that get... And he came up with a solution where the best way of packing those spheres would be putting like a fifth sphere in the space left by the four on the base, so that you create this pyramid. A little bit like the cannonballs, you know, when they go stacked. However, people have been thinking about this long and hard. And this group of researchers at MIT, they have come up with a way of solving the problem and optimizing this through like a mathematical tweak. Yep. And this is like the Fourier transform. Fourier transform is just like, a transformer that allows you to transform data from one space into a much simpler space. And of course, when you have large volumes to pick, this allows you for much faster computation. So what they do, let's imagine that you have a container that you have to fill up with objects of different shape. They approximate all these objects in the empty space to cubes, and they actually project these on a grid. And then what they do, they compute the clashing between the different cubes, just to actually dumb down a little bit what they did. They voxelize it, so they have this representation in voxels, and then they compute this collision matrix, and they optimize this collision matrix. So now, because they use this Fourier transform, everything becomes much, much faster. So this algorithm is free to use. It's featured in an open source paper. It's very important to advertise that.
Yeah.
And can help in huge departments of, say, human society, from shipping goods to optimizing anything like that you can imagine all, right? There is actually an advantage in tackling these kind of problems mathematically.
Yeah.
Let's say.
And speaking of difficult mathematical problems, you're saying intelligent people have been found to take longer to solve complex problems.
Yes, apparently so. So it's like a revenge, you know, over intelligent people, in the sense that it's a study that has been published on Nature Communication recently, and this has been looking at almost 1,200 people. from what's called the Human Connectome Project. And these people have been given the so-called PEN matrix reasoning test, which is, let's say, a set of tests that looks at how humans are able to abstract concepts or solve complex problems. It is actually increasingly difficult, so you get given a sort of like problems to solve from the easiest to the most complex. And it turns out that people that have a higher IQ, supposedly more intelligent, of course, if you take these matrices seriously, they also take more time to solve complex problems. And this is very counterintuitive if you think about it, because if you are smarter, you should be taking less time. But what people tend to do is to look into the problems more thoroughly. And they try to find analytical solution to these complex problems. And of course, this requires more time to spend on the problem because they tend to overanalyze almost the problem.
So essentially they overthink.
They overthink, yeah. I guess intelligent people like to think. You may look at it their way. They actually related this ability to the connections that they have in the brain. And they found that supposedly intelligent people, again, higher IQs, have like a much more connectivity between two lobes in the brain, parietal and frontal lobe.
Right.
And this speaks for the ability of cross-talking between collecting the information and analyzing the information. So they seem to have better connection.
That's interesting. So the way that they've defined intelligence is people that have higher IQ or... That's interesting. And where was the study from? Sorry, again?
You find me a little bit unprepared there because I didn't note this down. I will have to get back to you on that.
Yeah, we'll pop it in after the show, we'll pop it in the podcast so people, if they want to read more about that.
Absolutely.
They can.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah. It is very fascinating. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Davide, for coming in and talking to us today.
It's been great.
That has been great.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And we have a bit of time, so I'm just going to jump into a track now. This is Surly, You Thirsty. Oh, and it's not playing. Let's try that again.